Do you have a statement, Senator?
No, not really. I'm not entirely sure what it is that you want me to discuss. But in any case, it's always good to be back in Missouri. And I especially enjoy coming to Kansas City and to have the opportunity to view this nursing home about which I've heard so much from Tom. I frankly can't understand why there was ever the danger or the crisis. But in any case, it's open now, thanks to his efforts and Senator Symington's, and especially the young man upstairs by the name of Roger Buckmaster.
Senator, presidential advisor Robert Finch was in Kansas City recently, and he charged that George Meany and Big Labor are going to pick the next Democratic presidential nominee. Do you think Meany and Labor have that much control of the Democratic Party?
Well, I don't believe so. They are obviously a political force of considerable significance. I wouldn't say they don't count. But I don't think the Democratic Party in its present condition is about to be managed by any one or any group. I've learned that in the last couple of days myself.
Senator Muskie, at the Governor's Conference in Puerto Rico, Governor Dockey in Kansas indicated that he likes Nixon because of the economic policies, but he could support you. What kind of support do you think you can get from Kansas?
Well, I'll tell you, I may have an opinion on that after I spend a night with Governor Dockey.
Senator, opinion is about evenly divided here, that if you are the Democratic presidential nominee, then either Governor Hearns or Governor Dockey would be your running mate.
Well, wouldn't it be nice to have at least two, then?
What credentials does a vice presidential candidate must have if you are the nominee?
Well, I can tell you what Vice President Humphrey told me were the important credentials, and he indicated his interest in me. He said the first qualification of a candidate for vice president is to be qualified to be president. I can't think of a better way to put it. I think also he ought to represent in this day and age continuity of policy if in the event anything should happen to the president. And then of course in one man or one woman, you've got to find a way to balance the ticket so that all Americans will feel the ticket is a representative one. I don't think that's as easy a task when you could do it on a geographical formula basis or some other such arbitrary basis. But I think the American people are concerned with the office of the vice presidency more than ever before because of recent experiences. And so I'm sure that once either party has nominated its candidate for president, that more thought and more consideration will be given to the vice presidential candidate than ever before.
Does Mr. Hearn's endorsement of you enhance his position if you were nominated?
Well, I thought very highly of him before, and I certainly think no less of him now.
Who will be your toughest competitor for the nomination, do you feel, at this point?
Well, you fellows are so much more objective about that sort of question, I prefer to leave it to you.
Senator, the networks and some big city newspapers have charged that your statement about a ticket with a black vice presidential candidate could not be elected is a statement that is likely to have the same effect on you if you decide to run as George Romney's brainwashing statement had on him. Would you comment on that?
Well, again, I couldn't comment on it, but I think that blacks themselves have been urging upon us the facts of their inequality in America for a long time, and especially since the Kerner Commission report of a year or two ago, which in dramatic and shocking terms identified the inequalities to which blacks are subject in our society. Whether one talks of health care or educational opportunity or employment opportunity or housing opportunity, and I don't think it excluded political inequality. And why, at this point, when the country is beginning to focus upon these inequalities, everyone should find it especially shocking to be confronted with the fact of Negro political, black political inequality is a little surprising to me. It's evident that blacks are about 11%, I think, of our population, and there's one black in the Senate of the United States. That doesn't represent political equality. There are how many in the House?
14.
14, I think, out of 435. That certainly is not political equality. There isn't a single black who's governor of a state. That's certainly not political equality. Black has never been elected vice president or president. That's certainly political inequality. So I think it's a healthy thing to recognize the facts as to the inequality of blacks. I think that's the only way we can come to grips with these situations and correct them. I hope to live the day, see the day when any American, including blacks, is eligible for any office, including the highest offices of this land, and that ought to be our objective. But I don't think we should fool ourselves about these things, and I hope I'm wrong when I cite these facts. But when I see statistics that prove that a black child has an 80% greater chance of dying before his first birthday than a white, I think that's a good fact to know. That if we didn't know it, we wouldn't do much about it. And when I see statistics that tell me that a black has a 90% better chance of being unemployed than a white man, I think that's a good fact to know. And I don't think that I would be doing a service to the country to conceal it. Well, then why, I ask myself, you know, is this one inequality so verboten? Why is this one inequality the one not to be talked about out loud so that we can look at it and correct it?
One other criticism, Senator. Eric Severide was recently assessing what he said were all your assets as a man likely to become president of the United States. But he pointed out what he said, your one liability is that you're trying to be all things to all people as a candidate. Could you comment on that?
Well, that isn't the way I hear it. I'd invite Mr. Severide to sit in my office and read my mail and travel with me around the country and hear the criticism to which I'm subjected. If that's my objective, I haven't succeeded very well, I assure you.
Senator, do you have any particular vision for America that you would like to see come into play if you were president? Roosevelt had the New Deal and Kennedy had the New Frontier and Johnson had his version of what the Democratic vision would be. What would do you have any name for your vision, or do you have a description of it at the moment?
Well, I don't like those kinds of names and labels. I suppose they're handy, especially if they're short enough to put in a headline, or to put at the top of an editorial. And of course, we need words to describe what we want to do if we're elected to office. What I'd like to do, or what I'd like to see done, beginning in 1973 and earlier, if we could get President Nixon turned around on it, is to convert the spirit of negativism which sweeps this country and which dilutes us of the ability to come to grips with problems that undermines our ability to shed our fears and suspicions and our hatreds into a feeling of positivism. I have great belief in this country and its capacity to do the decent thing for our own people and for other peoples. And yet we're not responding to that sense of decency as we have at our best moments in our country's history. And I've seen some of those best moments. And I like the clean feeling of being an American in those best moments. Well, we're not at a time of our best moments at the present time. We can think of more reasons why we cannot do things than why we should do them. And we have the resources, whether we speak of material resources or spiritual or intellectual or practices in the arts of freedom and the testing of the ability of free people to govern themselves. I think all of these are resources that we can apply to every problem that I could identify or that you can identify that confronts us here at home and abroad. There's no reason why we can't govern cities. There's no reason why a country with a $1 trillion economy can't provide decent jobs and decent housing and decent health care and decent neighborhoods and safe streets and safe cities for all our people. There's no reason why we can't help children break out of the cycle of poverty which imprisons them and makes them the mistakes and the failures of our society eventually. These are things we can do, and we're inhibited not by a lack of resources, but by attitudes and fears and doubts that we need to correct. And I think that's the challenge that faces the next president of the United States. Now, I don't have a phrase for that. But I think that our objective must be, I think we have a unique duty as a nation to prove that there is at least one place on this earth where even the least member of a society can reach out for full justice. And That's what I think America's always represented, and I'd like to advance our country toward that objective.
Gentlemen, can we have one more question? The senator's about
to... you just described a massive, a gigantic job there. How would you go about changing all those attitudes?
Well, you can't do it instantly, obviously. Sometimes the man who's president can find a phrase or in one speech can help do that. Roosevelt did it in his inaugural address in 1933. He turned the country around and immediately. And I remember that very well. I was an 18-year-old college freshman at the time. And overnight, there was just a fresh breeze that swept through the country. We didn't solve every problem, but we began to go about the work of doing so as though we believed we could do it for the first time in 3 or 4 years. And I think Jack Kennedy had something of the same effect on the country with his inaugural address. We again began to have the clean, constructive feeling of being able to do things. Now, what a president might be able to use, you know, depends upon what the circumstances are when he takes office. It's a little difficult when, you know, you're a non-candidate or a potential candidate. You know, you don't have the levers of power. You don't have the national forum. You don't have the national attention. Even if I should make a speech, you know, in Springfield, Missouri, that had that electrifying quality, it would only be heard by the audience. It wouldn't be heard by the nation. But whatever it is, presidents are uniquely in the position to find the symbols or the ways or the words or the speeches or the ideas or the initiatives that can turn the country around. It has to do, of course, a lot to do with the quality of leadership which a man offers to a country. I mean, his qualifications, his personality, his characteristics, and so on. So any man who seeks it has to test, you know, people's reaction and response to him. And if they are like that of Mr. Severi, that I'm trying to be all things to all men, why, then that's rather bland. That won't work. That isn't good enough, I might say.
Thank you, gentlemen.